Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June the 15th, 2000. In the fireside room this afternoon is Ron Dwyer Voss. Today's session number is 2003 and is titled Living the Promise, Claiming the Inheritance, Mutual Self-Help Housing, Beyond Habitat for Humanity, Building Community. Let's listen in.
Called Mutual Self-Help Housing, Beyond Habitat, Building Community, or something like that. Can't remember what I named it, nor what it ended up on the board to be. What the purpose of the session is to talk about a program called the Mutual Self-Help Housing Program, and it's an affordable housing program that tries to build community in the process. The best way I've found to explain the program is to usually start with one people are more familiar with, which is Habitat for Humanity. More familiar model. How many folks here have participated in any way with Habitat? Or can you talk about briefly what your participation was?
Well, our congregation sponsored a home, and it meant going over there once a week on Saturday. We had one person that was in charge, and so it was everything from bringing lunches to putting up drywall, hammering nails. Okay. And then also we did sponsor, along with that, we had a very close relationship with the person who was receiving the home. We had a mentor that was working with her. She was a mother of three, and so she worked with the mother. Well, I'm not quite sure.
Okay.
I'm guessing that it. I know that they worked probably on just maintaining a good communication, working relationship, friendship, so that she would have somebody. Maybe this person was like a liaison between the facility that was giving and she was the receiver.
What was your?
I was recently on the board of the Shoman Manson chapter, and that chapter has built about 5 houses in 6 years. This
okay.
past year, they chose to rebuild and not try to build a house.
Okay.
But my observation is that certain people who have skills. Have done in that area anyway, have done most of the work, and that it's not as inclusive as it's supposed to be.
Okay.
I'm not sure, but I think some of that is both sides. The community isn't responding as well as it might, and the people who have all the skills are not real good at delegating work.
Right. How are you all involved?
I've worked on the Family Selection Committee. Habitat's been new in our community, and I think this is our third house, so the third family that we've selected. And
what community is that?
Nevada County.
Rex Valley.
Oh, that's right. That's right. So you guys are on your third house now,
right?
And you've been involved in the Family Selection.
Working with them, deciding which families to choose.
Okay.
And Bob's done the hard work with the Nappas and Nails.
Yeah. Okay. We were just going around quick, touching base on any experience people had with Habitat for Humanity. go ahead.
Sorry, I'm late. My name is Nadia Boltover. I live in Ephrata, Washington. I'm the board of directors of the Upper Columbia Basin Habitat for Humanity. It's a small rural affiliate. We have like 4 different little towns. And it was first in Quincy, and we built 2 houses there. We just started on our third. We just broke ground 2 weeks ago in Ephrata on our first home there. And then I volunteered other places I've lived.
Other involvements? You've done habitat stuff?
Yeah, in both in uptown Chicago and the west side of Chicago. I've done a lot of work producing volunteers, working a little bit with folks. And then for the last couple of years, we're on some of the staff. We've keynoted a couple of conferences for them, and some of them are beginning to think about I'm keynoting their next national conference, and the thing that they want to do is to think about how houses can produce community, not just houses. That's the point. So.
Great segue. That's what the session's about. But I want to talk a little bit about, because Habitat does some things really well, and I want to start there, and then we'll talk about the Mutual Self-Help Housing Program and what it does well. And some of you already hit on what Habitat does well. What's Habitat for Humanity do well?
Build houses.
Okay.
Emerge volunteers.
Houses? Huh?
Emerge volunteers.
All right.
Raise funds.
Volunteers. Money.
Involve churches.
Right.
And prisons. Because we have another one where prisoners are working together to make a wall or a...
It gives the homeowner a feeling of self-worth.
Okay, so we got volunteers and usually families, their self-worth goes up.
It works with families to teach them how to manage money and take care of the house and make house payments and that sort of thing, hopefully.
So there's a little triangle here, right? Volunteers, the recipient family, money management, in addition to the money needed for this. Now, 3 years ago, I was pretty up on all of Habitat's rules because they were easy to be up on because they were national and next to the Vatican. It was run about as top-down as any organization in the world. So it was really easy to know the rules. In the last few years, they've flexed a lot more. So if I say something that hasn't been your experience, let me know. Because also, more Habitat chapters are becoming rogue, or they're doing what they need to do in their community, even if Atlanta doesn't sign off on it. But for a long time, the rule was that you couldn't do the house till the money was raised, and there would be no interest on the house. I know that's flexed with some of the Habitat groups we work with in this Mutual Self-Help Housing Program. We'll talk about that. So what do you get at the end?
One house.
Well, this goes to...
What does who get at the end?
What comes... What does all this get you? Get you a house? Or you said Mance and Shalana done 5 and 6 years, so a house a year.
Yeah,
it's fairly typical rate, actually.
It seems to me to be a very slow way to solve a very big problem.
But you do get a house.
You do get a house. You get a family that hopefully benefits in many ways.
House.
You get a community cooperation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So community involvement.
I was just saying it gives the volunteer something. I don't want to say it's a sense of self-esteem, but something.
Right, you get a it's more than this, but you get a whole bunch of people in the community who are more aware of poverty in their community, the life that these folks try to live, what housing takes, why it's difficult for these folks to have decent housing, why they got to move around all the time, and what I think what Habitat really does very well for the entire nation is this piece here. You just have hundreds of thousands of volunteers who've touched a Habitat house at some point or another, and in the process gained at least some degree of greater understanding of affordable housing issues and poverty issues. And that's a big gift to our nation. And I think one thing you get also is usually a faith connection. It's one of the few affordable housing production machines in the country that consciously thinks about this house in terms of faith, and this family in terms of faith, and this hammering a nail in terms of faith. And there's whole biblical reflections and things like that. So it's very intentional. And that's useful too, because then without even touching a Habitat house, your church may be doing a four-week Bible study. My church last summer, the we call it Vacation Bible School for kids, was Habitat. So my kids never worked on a Habitat house, but they know about stuff just from that. Okay? So it produces quite a bit of stuff. And for those of us who work in the affordable housing industry and want to get as much affordable housing built as possible and are more interested in volume than other things, that piece about raising consciousness and having more people who may not have in any other way except that their church was involved, we're thankful for. Now I'm going to introduce the Mutual Self-Help Housing Program with about a 15-minute video that our organization produced with the Department of Agriculture, who sponsored this program. Lift the cap, thanks.
I was a cook, and she was a waitress, and we were working paycheck to paycheck, and basically we were talking on our own. Possibly the chances of getting a house were slim, you know, because you want to save, but also in reality of life, when you save, other things happen.
I work in the fields. We live in Paso Robles in a public housing. It's a bad place, drug dealers. I want a best life for my kids. Like, we are fathers of four kids, and I want a good life for him.
Always dreamed of owning my first home, but it seemed impossible because of my situation. My credit wasn't what it should have been because of going to farm work with picking oranges, having kids, no one would give you a chance because the banks said you don't have any stability credit, rent houses, you just don't have nothing to go by. So I felt that dream wouldn't be possible. But always deep down inside, I have that hope.
You always dream of having your own things. You see people, you know, in the neighborhood, you know, you see your friends, they own homes, and you have a desire to own your own home, but you know deep inside, really you ain't got that kind of money to put down on the home. And if you go to the bank, they're just gonna laugh at you and say, well, you know, you gotta have money down, and that's just something you don't have. And
we met for the first time in December of 1967, went on to start to build as soon as we could break ground in 68.
Since the 1960s, the United States Department of Agriculture has helped thousands of low-income families realize the dream of home ownership. Through a program known as Mutual Self-Help Housing, The USDA targets small towns and rural areas. The agency works in partnership with local community groups to help families build their own homes. Groups of 8 to 12 families who meet the program's qualifications spend the better part of a year working together in teams. When all of the homes are completed, the families move in. More than just houses, these families build neighborhoods and communities. Instead of money, their down payment is time and labor. Lives are transformed in the process.
Home ownership is a cornerstone of the American dream. People don't want to always have to live and be dependent on public resources. They really want to be self-sufficient.
To compare what self-help is like, I would have to say it's like having a baby. Because when you start, you're so excited you can't wait to get here. And because everything is new and you have so much to learn and you just can't wait to get started. And as the months go by, you got hurt. Your feet swell. You feel, you want to die.
Tired, it's hot. In our area, it's 100 degrees plus during the summer.
I think the first 3 months is the hot part.
Sometimes you just felt like you were gonna pass out.
I put my feet in the oven because my feet were so cold.
I have no time to myself right now. The only thing I keep going is the thought of moving into this house.
I appreciate it more than having someone else build. A lot of houses, other people build them for them, and they really don't appreciate it. But by me coming out here working, I will appreciate the value of my home.
Self-help housing has been one of the most important programs we've ever had in Chico County. It's cleaned up some neighborhoods that we really want to clean up. It's added some new additions. It provided people with a place to live that never thought of their own home.
It's been a tremendous economic boost to the city. A little over $1.5 million spent in land acquisition, attorney fees, contractors, and over $180,000 a year in building materials alone.
Twenty years ago, there were shacks all around. Today, we've built some 1,300 houses scattered all over Central Florida. And it's 1,300 families who have realized the American dream. We targeted this community in order that we may purchase the property directly across the street so that we can go in where the drug pushers are and push them out. Once we put families in there, they have to go. I mean, it's just real simple. They have to go.
Been in my home, it was a big turning point, you know, when we moved here in the new home, and if the house that we was living in, it was raining in there, and only one bedroom, and we had one baby bed, about three kids in one room, and it was just very uncomfortable.
I was working for a company, and I was only making $6 an hour. And making that $6 an hour, it only could go so far at that time, especially with the kids, you know, that I had.
The best thing that ever happened to Mr. Blackman was that he got an opportunity to own his house. We stabilized his family and set him on a course of prosperity.
This is the first set of houses they built with me. That's my neighbor there. When we first moved here, this was a swamp area. It was real wet all across here as this home was built. This is the daycare center, playground.
Getting my first home gave me the opportunity to do things that I don't think I know a way to do. I was able to build my business because of a new home, and build my esteem up, my wife living at a daycare center, to put something back in the community. Helping people to go to work because they had nowhere to take their kids. From that, we escalated into doing community service work.
But I also want to know, how much time did you have to put into that?
I watched the kids in this neighborhood walk the street with nothing to do. One kid, I took special interest in, Travis, took this kid and took him to work. And he enjoyed what he was doing.
He started changing his lifestyle. He was so proud of me, taking him off the street. He started bringing his honor roll card to me. He started making honor roll, and he'd bring his card and leave it here with me. So I helped taking kids off the street, give them a job, work them. Some had gone on to have better jobs. Well, you can't help yourself. You think you can't help someone else. When you get an opportunity to better yourself, okay, and giving a home kind of better my position, make you feel better for yourself. And I really think it was a breaking point in my life.
Trapped, and I was going nowhere, going nowhere fast, too. I didn't know where to turn and what to do about the situation, but just kind of keep my eyes and ears open all the time and try to find what would work for me, what would work for my family.
Hi.
This whole self-help construction thing really opened up new doors to me. The program manager, Hank Wakefield, was describing what we'd be going through, what we'd be doing. And after we got done the meeting that night, I stopped to talk with him. I said, Hank, I said, this is what I want to do someday. I want to build these houses. I want to be on the employee end of this.
This seems like a lot of benefits. This one of the benefits right here.
No, this will be your living room.
So
the house is set this way. Living room right here, the front. This is your living room. Dining room behind it.
They hired me 3 weeks after I moved into my house. And since that time, I've moved up from construction associate to construction supervisor to self-help housing program specialist, I think I'm called now. So I've moved up the ladder since being a part of the program.
We need housing for low and moderate income people. They are the backbone of our community. They're the ones who flip the burgers and the ones who take your money at the lift tickets, you know, at the ski resorts. Today's self-help housing client, maybe tomorrow's school board member, and those folks are important to us, and we want to make sure that their kids grow up in a safe environment.
It was all worthwhile because I got my kids out of the city. I got into a place where they can run and play. They can have fun, you know.
No, their grades went way up. One of my children had like C's and D's, and he's up to, you know, getting B's.
It's a sense of independence. It's a sense of working for yourself, you know. When we were renting, we had nothing. This is where we chose to finally build our house. We're up in there with the kids checking it out. And there we are, taking the first shovel full of dirt. Just like you have.
After about 3, I would say, months of going with all the children and every month standing up and asking for service, the families decided they were going to get active. They even put a can
candidate up to run for the board of directors. And after about a year and a half struggle, we finally got approvals.
Memory we have of accomplishment is when they said, okay, you guys will be building a house.
And he runs out and he just grabs me. We got accepted. I'm like,
getting a house.
When they found out what lot that we were going to get, they drove down and they got out of the car and they sat on the lot and dreamed about this house. They would go down there every night after work and sit on the lot and dream about the house.
All American families, a house is always an accomplishment.
Yeah.
Building a home. Mm-hmm. Having a place where your kids can come and say, this is home, this is home. I come every day to this very day. I work all day, come home, and all I say when I walk in the door, I'm home, this is home. Mm-hmm. And so it just gives you a good feeling about yourself. I don't think we would have opened our own restaurant had we not built our own house. For what reason? Confidence. Insurance. If you could do that, you could do whatever you want. I stress that to my kids today.
They have a restaurant. It's called Rudy Nanji's. It's very successful. It's become a landmark. A lot of people go there that knew them in the first restaurant.
One of the supervisors, when they asked me, so after all you've been through, like, what would you do it again? I said, yeah, I would do it again. How else am I going to get home for my children? Of course I would do it again. In the end, you know, everyone around you, they're your friends, they're more like family than their friends, because you spent almost a year working with them, working right next to them in the mud, building the houses together. You built their house, they built your house, you did everything together.
I think the self-help program goes back to the barn raising days, and it's so American, where people used to get together and help one another. We see the self-help building process as building neighborhoods and building communities. People get to know one another, they know who lives on their street, they feel secure in the neighborhood, they form neighborhood watch programs after they've moved in, they help one another. It's really a unique opportunity, I think, for neighborhoods to be built from the grassroots up.
This program has helped so many people to have lots of hope. Without this program, I think a lot of people would give up.
I see a lot of people just, they blossom. It's like watching a flower open up. They really start to not only learn about construction, but they learn a lot about themselves.
Pay income tax. We used to get a huge refund. We used to get more money than we pay in. You know? Now we're paying taxes. I like that.
Now we look at life, I think of myself as being rich. Because, you know, I own my own home and something I never had before. So I feel rich.
Open the windows. Yeah. Someone mind hitting the lights back on? Thanks. So I probably should explain a couple things before the video. Then obviously there's a little USDA promo in there. They paid for this, so we had to get some of that in. And to their credit, there are places where they're integral. I mean, they are integral. They fund the whole dang thing. But where their staff are actually helpful, and there's other places where that's not the case. It talked about people who are eligible for the program. Explain a little bit about the program, and then I want to hear what you heard in the video. the eligibility is for low and very low income people. And each state gets an allocation, and there's some quota stuff that goes on there. And low income meaning that they make 80% of what the median income in their area is. Very low income meaning they make 50% or less of what the median, the middle income in that area is. The other piece that they have to qualify for is what's called a 502 mortgage. It's a USDA mortgage that comes back from when USDA was, when this part of USDA was focused on farmers who already had their land. So you got a mortgage for your house and to put in the infrastructure. And, so you have to qualify for that. It's a sliding scale. It goes down to 1%. And then each year it's adjusted based on your income. So as the, you're never paying more than 28% of your income towards your housing. And credit, of course, these days is the key issue for that qualification. Because they can bring the interest rate down, and you can do a lot more with interest than you can with cash in terms of qualifying somebody. But with, you know, credit companies will give anybody a credit card these days, and a car salesman will figure out any way to get you a new truck, and that can kill your home ownership opportunities for about 5 years in a second. So we have families, when they come together as groups and they start off, they're presented with this issue, because it's going to be 3 or 4 months before they get that mortgage to buy that lot. And they usually talk about how they're going to do that. And some of them give all their credit cards to somebody to hold. Some of them cut them up, they have ceremonies. Some of them put them in a bag of water in a freezer somewhere. So you have it, if you know it's an emergency and you really need it, it has to get thawed out. And, there's all kinds of techniques folks use. So the first qualification is income. Similar to Habitat in that respect. Second is you got to be able to qualify for that mortgage. And then the third is that you have to be willing to sign the Mutual Self-Help Housing Building Agreement. And the basic tenets of that agreement are that you'll work 40 hours a week for about 9 months. So when the guy referred to, I don't have any time to myself, that's what he's talking about. Folks come after work in the evenings and then all day Saturday, all day Sunday for about 9 months. And you agree that you will not just work on your house, you will follow the instructions of the construction superintendent and the group leader that's elected. And everybody works on everybody's houses. They're groups of 8 to 12, usually. And nobody moves in until everyone moves in. If you fall behind on your hours, in most agreements, your house stops getting worked on until you make up those hours. Now there's all kinds of ways, you know, people can bring in cousins to help or people with disabilities, you know, there's all kinds of ways to do it, but somehow your hours got to get checked off. So you have to put your own time in, the self-help part, and you have to do it with this group. And you first meet this group when they talk about Rudy Mangi applied and Rudy came running and said, we've been accepted. And the next thing that happened was that they met 11 other folks who had been accepted and started a group process to learn about homeownership, pre-homeownership counseling, what the construction process was going to be like, a lot of credit counseling, a lot of loan packaging, and the person who does that's a loan packager that's paid for by a grant from USDA. But in that process, too, they're setting out the rules that they're going to operate by. And then they get handed to a construction superintendent. My favorite is the guy, I don't know if you saw him, he's got a beard down to here. It looks like ZZ Top. He's been doing this for 15 years, teaching family. He was a contractor making 100 grand a year on the coast of California. And just said, forget it, I'm not getting any meaning out of this. So he teaches people how to build their houses. The rules for those guys, and that woman went on to be construction supervisor. And the rules for those folks is outside of the infrastructure and it's taking things off. They're supervisors, they can't do the work. They teach you how to do the work. They'll have a session on how to use circular saw and they'll show what's supposed to happen and then you gotta do it. And they'll, you know, house can go this way, they're gonna help you back. Their main role is to say no. There's house plans. And people go, hey, people start getting good at this. We kind of like this living room to be bigger and the bedroom to be smaller. Can we move the wall over? After you move in, you can do whatever you want. But you know, otherwise, this is going to take 2 years to do a change. And every year, every time there's a new construction supervisor, they learn that one the hard way. So those are kind of the basic rules of the program. Now, sometimes Luke Kellum, the guy in Florida, you know, they went into a community and they just, you know, group of 12, 3 months later, another group of 12, 3 months later, another group of 12, until they pretty much built out a town. Gridley, California, the white woman with the long hair who was talking about this is pregnancy, that town went through 8.5 years of legal litigation first before the nonprofit who does this was able to even buy, or if they bought the land, to develop the land so that people could buy the lots. But now 55% of the houses in Gridley are self-help houses. There's a border town, Brawley, California, 85% of the houses in Brawley are self-help houses. So in some communities it works that way. In other communities it's more a little more scattered about. And it varies by region. In the Navajo Nation, people start feeling claustrophobic if the next house is closer than 5 miles away. There's a cultural issue there that had to be worked in. That's a struggle. So, Gail.
The form that you just talked about, the land acquisition and the cost and all that, does it have to be a minimum of 9 or 11 to make all that work out?
8 to 12 is optimal efficiency. Okay. You start going below 8 and it gets hard.
Okay.
For a number of reasons.
Do other community members assist with this project?
In some places, yes, and in some, no. And that's something I wanted to talk about a little bit. The first time I wanted to come back to remind me of that, and I got it down here too. One of the purposes of the workshop. But what did you see in that video, and from what you've heard of that process, that this program's good at? Mutual self-help housing.
Building neighborhoods. One project like that existed in Manson, there'd be 12 houses built a year instead of one.
Mm-hmm. And so, what else did you see in the video?
Skill building.
Mm-hmm. I have a question.
Yeah.
The amount of money that they end up paying for the house, is it more than Habitat homeowners paying for the houses?
Yeah.
It is.
It's based on what they can afford.
Are based on
the sliding scale.
But maybe for longer or higher interest?
The interest is recalculated each year.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things, you know, you saw the Blackman family went on to start a business and child care center.
Mm-hmm.
The Lopez's have two restaurants now. And which is not untypical. We had no problem finding these stories. And no problem finding mayors like that woman in Maine and that judge in Arkansas. What we had a problem with was fighting over who would continue the video. Because there's all kinds of success stories. And one of the ways we measure the success is that in the self-help housing program, the average amount of time that it takes a family, most of them are very low-income families, to get to USDA's market rate interest is 7 years. So 7 years after a self-help home, they're paying market interest mortgage because they can afford it, because their lives have changed that much economically from building a house. And sometimes it's a business, sometimes it's a restaurant, sometimes it's just confidence in the workplace and promotions. It's any number of things. They're getting equity. They own this house. They get the equity out of this house, and then they'll maybe take a home equity loan or a mortgage and go do something with it. Many a self-help housing owner have put their kids through college with the equity in these houses.
Mm-hmm. Do they get to make whatever percentage of money the houses in the area go up during the time period? Do they sell at market?
They do sell at market, and then there's a repayment back to USDA. It's because that interest rate. So if let's just say this year USDA's market rate was 7%. It's usually a little below what you pay at the bank. And this year you had a 1%. Well, there's an interest subsidy there. USDA writes that down.
Mm-hmm.
They remember. So when you sell, you pay that back out of your equity if you can. There's a complicated formula which people who in this business spend tons of hours arguing in Washington about what it should be. But the intent of the formula is to allow people to capture a good amount of the equity, because they put in the hours, they took the risk, all that kind of stuff that equity's for. But at the same time, to put some money back, theoretically, for the next folks. So they pay some of that back, but not all of it.
Now, the business folks kept saying, we got business because of self-esteem, or confidence, or whatever. But are they an option to refinance those houses to help start businesses? I mean,
they can do home equity loans. To finance those, and a lot of them are able to now, they built a home, they're making good on their payments, and they can walk into a bank now and get a small business loan. So they don't have to use that piece. Now they usually put their home up as collateral for that loan.
If they sell a house, does the loan go with it, or is it open market?
No, open market. Now, most of the agencies that do this work, they have these huge waiting lists of people who want to get in this program. So when a home comes up, it usually goes to somebody who would qualify for a 502 loan, because you can use a 502 loan to buy a house that's already been built.
You cannot?
You can. There's the 502 loan pot is divided into a number of purposes, and one of them is that.
Is there a limitation on the size of these homes?
When I first got exposed to this program about 5 years ago, they had just gone through a huge change that everybody was in a huge celebration about. It's kind of like walking into a party that you didn't know what's going on. Until about 5 years ago, USDA and the local office dictated a whole bunch of things about these houses. Square footage, had to be single car garage, bedroom sizes, amount of hallway space, all kinds of stuff. It was just ridiculous. It was 5 pages long of what you can and can't do. And there was a state architect at every USDA has a state office. And the state architect would have to approve the plans, make sure they met the regulations. And then through years of advocacy, the nonprofit agencies and families got that changed to a value-based formula. So as long as the home is a kind of reasonable home, and there's ways to calculate this, then it's okay. And so then it becomes up to the agency, and the good agencies make it up to families, If you guys want fireplaces, you can't have the front porch. It doesn't fit. Here's what we're working with. If you don't want the fireplace, you can have the front porch and probably back patio. Whereas other the single car garage went out, which was rigged for California. There was a great, we call it the Collishaw Garage. There's a guy named Tom Collishaw in Visalia, California, who works for Self-Help Enterprises, which I'll talk about in a minute, but they're the folks who sort of started this program. And he looked at this, you know, you had to have a single car garage, and that was dictated by the number of square feet. And but what was happening is next to the garage, you often had kitchen, and so you usually had this little room here that was your washer, dryer, that kind of stuff. And it was a separate little room because it couldn't be a garage, right? Mm-hmm. So what he did is he extended this out, and he put on a two-car garage door. Now, when it went up, what you saw here was the laundry room, and what you saw here was a place for one car. So it met the regulations, but it fit into these communities in California that were stopping houses because they didn't fit what the rest of the houses looked like. And that, the Collishaw garage, was the beginning of the end of these kind of micro regulations. Because they realized that with some thought, you can pretty much design a way out of any of your constructs.
Did they build them with the thought of energy efficiency in mind?
In Arizona, especially. In Arizona, some are using straw bales. To the degree that can be afforded, they do. It just depends. There's a place. One agency in Gilroy, California, which is right down the road from the Milgard Windows factory. Milgard Windows are great windows. And that, you know, the great story there is that nobody who worked in that factory ever could afford a home. Most of them were living two families to an apartment because the Santa Clara, Silicon Valley income was pushing on the real estate market in this little town called Hollister. And so this agency raised some extra funds to make sure every house had Milgard Windows. So that they can have that, and that came with a certain amount of efficiency too.
Could you just talk just a quick moment on what types of agencies you identify do these in different communities?
Yeah, why don't I go into that? Because I think you guys got the point here in terms of the video. People get skills, they get confidence, they get a neighborhood, usually one they're close to, and then an extended one because all this is going on. They also get the other thing that these folks know way more about their house than I know about mine. And so if you go back to a self-help house built 20 years ago, it's still very well kept, well landscaped, and they know how to fix things and stuff like that. You know, a lot of us don't know how to do.
So do you think then with Habitat Homes that there's so many people working on the home other than the homeowner?
Right, that's been our experience. There are several self-help housing agencies that are Habitat chapters, and that's where we got involved in a lot of negotiations with National Habitat, because we had to break a lot of rules, mortgage. The families had to, you know, step up and do this much work, which was not a requirement. And those folks have found that exactly to be true. Now what happens is it's not just, you know, me and my family are building our house. Everybody's working on everybody's houses, and that rule, nobody moves in until everybody moves in. But I might be good at plumbing, and the construction supervisor might see that, and see that Gaylord is too, and put us kind of on a little plumbing team. We go through the houses. And you and Carol might be good at framing, and so you'll be on a framing team and go through. And so that it kind of, so when you're done, everyone kind of knows who's good at what if something goes bad. Instead of calling the plumber, you call Gaylord. Hey, Gaylord, this thing went out, and I never touched a pipe this whole damn process. Can you get over here and help me figure this out? And the other piece is that about 75-80% of labor is done by women. Just because. That's a phenomenon of the Western United States. I'm not sure if that's true nationally, but that's our experience in the West, where half the self-help agencies are.
Mm-hmm. Are there a lot of single parent families headed by women? Is that one of the reasons for the numbers?
No, it's because usually the guy's working.
Well, I think the sweat equity on Habitat houses is also would probably also say that.
Yeah. But there are more and more single parents, mostly single mothers, but not exclusively, coming into this program. So the Gillard asked about the types of agencies. So I'm going to give you an example of one. It's called Self-Help Enterprises, based out of Visalia. You saw that that footage that was clearly a videotape of a Super 8 wall raising. That was in the early 60s in a place called Goshen, California, right outside of, yeah, everybody's got Goshen. So guess who was involved? Mennonites, as well as the Quakers. And they were interested in farm workers and farm worker housing conditions. And so they were in the Goshen area around Visalia, and this one guy, and he said, you know what, you know, they had been doing this and that and all kinds of things. And he sat down and he drew out a house plan on a lot that they had bought with money from the Mennonite Central Committee. And he said, I'll bet you if we gave them the training and the tools, farm workers could build their own houses. And that was sort of the mythological but also historical beginnings of this type of thing. And so they organized some farm workers together, and that footage was some of the first groups doing this, coming together and building housing together. And those houses still stand. The first one's actually purple right now. And that spawned Self-Help Enterprises, which began this work and continues to be the largest producer. They do, I don't know how many hundreds of a year houses.
They're not volunteers assisting in this then?
No, Self-Help Enterprises is a nonprofit, 501c3 organization. And what they do is they go out and figure out where the land is that they can purchase, and so they'll buy, and this is all through the South San Joaquin Valley, which is bigger, would be the 12th largest state if it was its own, and would be the poorest state in the nation if it was its own. So they go to communities and they find land, and then they'll buy it, and then they'll get money from here, there, or wherever. And they'll put in the infrastructure. So they'll put in streets, wastewater system, water system. They'll either connect it to a town, ideally. But in some of these communities, they're way out remote permaculture communities that don't have that. So they have to put in a whole water and wastewater system for the whole community just to get the subdivision rolling. And so then they get each lot set. They do all that. Meanwhile, they got somebody else recruiting families and putting these groups of families together and loan packages and all that piece, and working with USDA to get the loans approved. And so then once you got your group of families together, they're handed to a construction supervisor here who's paid to show up every day. And puts in about 50-60 hours a week for about 10 months a year. And then it, usually during rainy seasons, is their vacation. So they'll work with this group, and then the next group will come along, and this guy will get his group, and the next group will come along and get his, and you get good competitions going. And usually on Sunday afternoons, there's some kind of barbecue and party and things like that. But so the agency staff usually has a land developer, he has a group worker who's usually maybe was a bank teller or low-level bank person who was bilingual usually and brought over and trained in group technique and group dynamics. The construction supervisor, usually a contractor, who again got trained in a lot of group dynamic stuff. And then that's the staff of kind of your average program. And your average self-help program produces about 1 to 3 of those a year. One to three of these 8 to 12 groups a year. Self-help enterprises will do 30. They'll have 30 in place at any given time, so it's a fairly sizable agency, 40 or 50 people. And then that spins off. They have a rehab program too. So if they go in a community, and these houses over here are all a mess, they'll use different financing and go in and see if folks want to get their house rehabbed, and they'll try to use a self-help method or use subcontractors and all kinds of things. You know, rehab's always complicated. And so that's, and then they'll also, this is an agency that will build apartment buildings, which isn't a self-help process at all.
Co-ops?
Just a rental. Affordable rental, they own it.
Oh, the self-help
owners. Yeah, they own it. Self-help Enterprises owns it. And so they cobble together all the financing needed to build decent housing that accommodates in their area family sizes of 5 to 7 and rents of 300, 350 a month in an area that would command $700 or $800 a month. So then they manage that. In most cases, they put a resident board in place.
From what I hear, I mean, I love the idea of people sort of building neighborhoods, building these communities, and the idea of building that number of houses in that amount of time. Those things sound great to me. I guess the thing that I would that I like about Habitat is the involvement of churches.
Mm-hmm.
Involvement of whole communities, and I know that our affiliate always said we're building communities, not houses, but it feels like we're making the community that has a lot of monetary possessions feel good about themselves by helping to build this house, and then the people are just kind of left there with this house in the middle of this dilapidated neighborhood. There's this
one. Everybody drives by, that's the Habitat house.
Yeah, exactly. And so I would love to see Habitat be more into building neighborhoods and communities.
Well, and some of them are. And your point about, and it comes back to Carol's point of, are volunteers involved in this at all? And the answer is yes. Self-help enterprises, I bring them up for several reasons. Some of them is because they're the largest and most sophisticated, so it gives you an idea how far this can go. But also because they were started by a church group, and their executive directors have traditionally been church folks, and so they constantly bring in volunteer groups to help. They're real clear with those groups. I mean, there's a church youth group from near Lacey, Washington, goes down there every year, works on houses for 2 weeks. There's an international group that comes in once a year. But they're pretty clear about the role, which is, get some labor done, but you're not building this house for these people.
Mm.
You're helping them get their house built. You're getting the privilege of being part of this process. So they do it for that piece that Habitat does so much well, which is raise consciousness. They usually bring them in at that 4th to 5th month, which, because it really is like pregnancy. I mean, these people, 4th to 5th month, they're just dragging. And then 8th, 9th month, when they can start seeing it finished up, they get charged up again. So the self-help's got enough groups going at any time that they usually inject volunteers at that point, because it brings in some new energy, new faces. Also, some other groups use local, they don't bring all just outside volunteer groups. they use local folks. One that I particularly loved was the one in Hollister, California, in the south of the Santa Clara Valley. The construction supervisor there said, you know, it's great we're building neighborhoods, but this town's been really opposed to Latinos and farm workers living in the town, and so the subdivision's all way over here, and this is great. We got